it gave us this sense of progress. It helped that effect that, hey, we're moving towards something in a unified direction. So even our calendar kind of gives us this idea that we're progressing. And then once you have the technology and the science so forth moving in that direction, you begin to, it all kind of comes together and you think, hey, progress is being made. We're working towards something. And so scientists looked like magicians in some ways, opening up cures and things. There's a lot of confidence in the turn of that century in human reason and the ability to rationally think through things. And if we can collectively just use the mind of human beings, then we can make progress, and we're seeing progress. So reason and rationality is very much a part of that confidence. And so if you live in that society and you believe that you're working towards progress and things are moving in the right direction, that gives you a lot of hope. And that means that you also have a lot of meaning in your life, that when you go get a job, working on the railroad, working in the laboratory, or working just in society in general that's moving in that direction, then you're contributing to progress. And when we feel collectively like humans are working towards something, then we individually can have a hope as well. So that's how things felt at the end of the 18th century, that we as a collective society are moving towards something greater. And that's not completely gone from our society, but I want to suggest to you that it's certainly not the same. Because beginning in the 20th century, we started to see a lot of negative things that came about from our advances. And the first big kind of blow to the advance of progress would be World War I. Because we started to see that we're capable of producing mass weapons, and that's capable of, it makes us capable of great violence as well. And so maybe, after World War I, we take a step back and say, I don't know, maybe this progress isn't, everything. There's some negative things about that. And that's where you get people like C.S. Lewis that served in World War I that start to, it makes them question and reason. And in his case, it made him come to God. World War II certainly had the similar effect. Weapons and technology gets greater, and humans are killed no longer in the hundreds, but in the hundreds of thousands. In battles and wars, and more people in the 20th century are killed in wars than were killed in several other centuries combined. And so the idea of progress is harmed by these wars. And what happens in an individual life, every individual is going to go through difficult times. You're going to go through a time where things don't feel right. You're trying to figure out your life and make sense of it, because something you expected to happen doesn't happen. Maybe you have a career planned out, and circumstances dictate that you're not going to be able to do that. Well, you have to reorient your entire life and think about what you're going to do. And so choosing a career, changing a career can make a big difference. But we have all sorts of things, deaths and sicknesses, and that can stop our idea of what our life looks like in the future as individuals. What happens in the 20th century is that we have that same type of thing that happens on an individual level. It happens on the level of society, that we have an idea where we're going as a society and what we're moving towards, and then that gets shattered. And these world wars are a big part of that. And so this progress that a man like Frederick Harrison is looking toward no longer looks so great. And we could document other things once you get into the 60s and so forth. Challenges and problems. I'm not going to get into all of the history. But I do want to suggest that our world has a very different feel to it than it did even during the age of World War II. That what we find today is something akin to what we looked at in Isaiah. That the twilight that we had longed for, the hope of civilization, of Western civilization, people don't collectively feel the same way about that anymore. And some of the evidence I would give to you for that comes in the form of our movies. Everyone has heard of the term utopia. A utopia is a society where everything works together, where everyone's working in harmony with each other, and everything is fair and just and symbiotic, and utopia is just a great place to be, the ideal place that you want to live. Well, what we have found in many of our movies recently, especially, is the opposite word, and that is dystopia. And so I just came up with some movies off the top of my head, and you start thinking in this genre, maybe you can list some on your own. The Hunger Games would be a dystopia. I've never seen The Hunger Games, actually, but it is about, you know, an oppressive kind of future civilization. Mad Max, I have some pictures, because I think this kind of illustrates visually. This is, the Mad Max from the Mad Max movie, where he's looking out at the world, and it's not a nice Garden of Eden-looking, beautiful place, shining. It's darker, it's desolate, it looks more like a desert. And so I suggest that images like this and movies that are made in that setting are not made in that setting just because, well, that's kind of a cool way to think about, you know, the future. It's because people feel this way. These movies resonate with people because it makes them feel the world of the movie has recreated something about reality for us. And so Mad Max, here's another movie, I Am Legend, if you've heard of that. This is New York as a, you know, dystopia, where it's overrun, its buildings are overrun with plants, and the streets are cracked, and animals are running around, and it's just one man walking among the ruins of what could have been a great civilization, what was a great society, but something happens with our science and technology, and it just, kind of the blink of an eye, it turns into this wasteland. And so our movies, the children's movie, WALL-E, is a movie that kind of depicts that as well, that the Earth is kind of a junkyard, a wasteland. And so there's a lot of movies within this genre, and the fact that these movies have gained in popularity, and particularly the fact that they are very popular with young people, is not just an arbitrary fact. It's an expression of what it feels like to live in the world for people nowadays. That the idea that our society is united and moving towards something great feels like something in the past. And now we start to feel like, well, we're here, and where do we go from here? It didn't turn out to be as great as I thought. And then we see that illustrated most darkly in the mass shootings that happened, and specifically the shootings that have happened in the high schools, in the schools, I guess, in general. This I'll put up a quote here from one of the Columbine killers, and I apologize for this is a serious quote, but I do want to illustrate what it feels like for young people, and this is an extreme version, but it's not it is representative of something that is that goes beyond just this individual. Eric Harris is one of the Columbine killers, and he writes in his diary, "The human race isn't worth fighting for, only worth killing. Give the earth back to the animals. They deserve it infinitely more than we do. Nothing means anything anymore." You know, what type of a mind lives in such a way that they think there's nothing, there's no meaning here? And you can say, well, that's an isolated person, and he's, you know, he had mental problems and so forth. Well, that may be true, and certainly that was true. But he is a product of the society that he lives in. And so even if everyone isn't going to go out and act out this way of living as he did, the idea that there is not meaning in human life and in human society is very much present, even for those who don't carry out these type of acts. And so between the movies that we see, the actions like this, it feels very different to live in our society than it looks. Because you go on to Facebook and Instagram and so forth, and you see, you know, people smiling and looking good, and we have nice cars, and we have, you know, a lot of great things. That's what it looks like. But I want to suggest to you that underneath all that, we're expressing something different about what it feels like. And I know I've painted a pretty bleak picture in talking about these things right now, but I think it's important to understand this picture if we're going to understand something about holiness. We live in a time where it's difficult to see meaning and purpose in where we're going and what we're doing. And we try to give young people particularly the idea that, well, you know, you get a career and you can save and you know, have a family, and that's all good. Those are meaningful things. But that's not ultimately as meaningful as what we're made for. And so this inability or struggle to find purpose and value in human life is growing, and I would be surprised if many of us here haven't felt the weight of that. And so, young people don't necessarily want to do things that are profitable as much as they want to do things that are meaningful. And so you see people that are willing to trade in higher paying jobs, and so forth, to have experiences. You know, they'll assume that I want to live my life and enjoy it while I can, because there's no meaning and hope in the future, so I need to go out and enjoy things now. And some of that you can say, well, that's, you know, youthful immaturity, and that's part of it. But it's also a sign that there's not much belief that there's something greater to work towards. So I need to get my meaning and my satisfaction now. And so Isaiah chapter 21, again in verse 9, I think kind of describes again how it feels to live in our society in some degree. "Behold, here come riders, horsemen in pairs. And he answered, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the carved images of her gods he has shattered to the ground.'" The society that we were working towards and felt like was happening at the beginning of the 19th century has now fallen. And that's a big part of what creates the divide that we see politically in America right now. That people on both sides of the aisle think that our society is either broken or has lost something, and that it needs to find meaning in some other way. Even those who want to, you know, preserve what they believe is good about America. The slogan, "Make America Great Again," that implies that something has been lost, doesn't it? This feeling that we lack a unified sense of direction and progress is manifest pretty much every day. And so our working towards Babylon has fallen. And that's when we need to look to the Bible and ask, well, how does the Bible help us to look for purpose and hope and direction? And I want us to use some of those images that we looked at with Mad Max and Will Smith there looking in I Am Legend to think about, well, where do we find something like that in the Bible? Where do we find a world where there is not a lot of hope, there's not really purpose and direction, where life is kind of snuffed out? Well, the Bible's main imagery for living in a hopeless world is the wilderness. The Bible has its own movie, so to speak, its own story about what it feels like and what it looks like to live in a place where there's not a lot of meaning and hope. Exodus chapter 16 in verse 1. Exodus 16 in verse 1. It says, this is after they've crossed the Red Sea. Israel has crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptian army has drowned. And it says in verse 1, "They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness." Why? You know, what's their problem? Well, what wouldn't be their problem? They're in the wilderness. This is not a place of salvation. And, you know, we can look back and say, oh, they couldn't trust God. And that's true. That is the point of the story. But just put yourself in their shoes for just a second and appreciate that being led out of Egypt and slavery and into a place where you don't see any food and water, if you don't think that would scare you, then I would beg to differ. And so they grumble and say, what are we even, why are we even here? What purpose does this serve? Okay, congratulations, we're out of Egypt. Now what? They feel hopeless and they don't even see any way to sustain life. In verse 3, the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." It would be better if we were dead. That's what they say. It would be better if we were dead. Do you remember the quote we just put from the Columbine killer? Nothing means anything anymore. That's what his conclusion was. It would be better if we were dead, and the animals, you know, they could just have the world. Because he felt like he lived in a wilderness where there's no meaning. The Israelites live in a wilderness, and they see no life. They see no purpose to why they're there, no direction. And so we might as well be dead out here. This is the Bible's version of a dystopia. We see the wilderness imagery used in the prophets a lot as well as a way to describe a civilization that had a lot of hope, that had made a lot of progress and seemed to be very meaningful, but had been turned into a shell of its former self, a ghost town, a dystopia. Jeremiah chapter 51. Jeremiah chapter 51 in verse 36. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I will plead your cause and take vengeance for you. I will dry up her sea and make her fountain dry. And Babylon shall become a heap of ruins, the haunt of jackals, a horror and a hissing without inhabitant. Babylon is the place. It's the place where there's technology, where there's information, education. It's where the best and the brightest are working to make humanity take it to the next level. And God says of Babylon, it's going to be like a wilderness. It's going to be a place where jackals and wild animals are running through it. I'm going to turn it, take that hope of man and show you what it looks like to me and show you what its true end is. Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2 and verse 3. Says, fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. This is an army. It's like a locust army in Joel. This great army that is just undefeatable. And he goes to describe this army that's going to come upon them, and he says, you know, they don't break ranks, and they're strict, and they're just like a machine that's going through cities and destroying them. I think of, when I think of this army in Joel, I think of Alabama football. They're just like a machine that goes through and they don't make mistakes and they just pick on the weaknesses. And this army just is like a machine. And that's what makes you know, dislike Alabama football. No offense to any Alabama fans in the room. But that's what this army is like. They keep going forward, and it's like they just can't be stopped. And before them, there's a Garden of Eden. Behind them, there's a wilderness. And God says, I'm going to bring that to my people. I'm going to turn it into a wilderness, because you have all of this hope and all of this progress and all of these things that you are thinking about. But they lead to this desolate society. Isaiah chapter 27 in verse 10. Isaiah chapter 27 in verse 10. Here's another city. The fortified city is solitary, a habitation deserted and forsaken, like the wilderness. There the calf grazes. There it lies down and strips its branches. When its boughs are dry, they are broken. Women come and make a fire of them. For this is a people without discernment. Therefore, he who made them will not have compassion on them. He who formed them will show them no favor. Can't you read these cities and just imagine this is a great movie setting for something today, that you would walk into this city that was once there. It was a fortified city, and now it's like a wilderness, and now there's animals running through it. Can you see the movies that we put out today looking like that? And that's because they represent the same thing. The same story that's here in the Bible is the story that we are trying to tell and trying to struggle with in our society right now. And that's good news because, of course, we want to find places in the Bible that help us to understand our times and where we live, because we know that the Bible will help us find out how to live during those times and how to get through those times. But you might ask the question again then, what does any of this have to do with holiness? Maybe this would be a good introduction to a series that was about hope, but how does holiness fit into what we're talking about? Well, in the middle of that wilderness, God called people, his people, to a new hope. And so he did give them something that they could work towards, something that they were going towards that was meaningful, that would be a Garden of Eden life, the promised land. But in order to enter into that hope, they had to learn to become holy in the wilderness. And so God gave them his tabernacle in the wilderness as a place where they could be tested, where they could become holy, where they could become obedient and faithful. And in shaping them in that wilderness into a holy people, he could bring them into his holy land. And so holiness has very much to do with hope, because holiness works towards a meaningful and purposeful life and existence. We're not going to take the time to look at all of the passages that we might of the descriptions of the tabernacle. We will look at some of those later today. But if you go and see the images that are talked about in the tabernacle, you see a couple of things. You see on the veil, you have the cherubim. I will ask a question. Where's the first place we see the cherubim in the Bible? In Eden, right? You see the cherubim in the Garden of Eden. And that's kind of what we find in the tabernacle, is we find a bunch of pictures and images of trees and birds and so forth. Again, I would encourage you to go look at some of those descriptions. And really what you find that the tabernacle is many things. But one of the things that it is a mobile Garden of Eden. It is a place in the wilderness that is walking with Israel. So you think of Israel walking through the wilderness, and you think, well, that's a difficult journey. You know, it was, because there's not a lot of water and so forth. But what would help you walk through the wilderness? What would be nice to walk through if you had some water and some food, right? Almost, maybe it would be nice to go through the wilderness if you had a mobile garden. And that's what God gives them. That's what God is for them. And so if you can almost imagine, you're watching from a satellite view as Israel goes through the wilderness. You see just a big brown patch of wilderness, not much there. And then you see this little green spot kind of moving along. Oh, that's Israel wandering through there. And this garden just kind of walking with Israel. And the problem with Israel, of course, most of the time is they turn their back on the tabernacle, and they're looking out in the wilderness, and they're saying, oh, there's nothing here. But if they would just turn around and look at, you know, God's tent, they would see they have a garden that's there for them, a source of life in the wilderness. But in order to interact with the tabernacle, in order to have that life and be prepared for that meaning, you had to be made holy. You don't come to God without being made holy. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 5. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 5. God says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." That's God's goal at Sinai and through the wilderness. I'm going to make you into a holy people, a holy nation. As Israel consecrated themselves to God, again, they would be prepared to enter into the promised land, which would be its own kind of version of a Garden of Eden, because God would be there and bless them with water and crops and all of the blessings that come with the covenant. And we see those blessings and the curses there in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 16, God says, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil." You can have a meaningful existence, or you can go back to a wilderness existence. If you obey the commandments of the Lord, he continues, of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. And again, the idea of them being fruitful and multiplying comes from the language of the Garden of Eden as well. And so they have set before them the path to holiness, and the path to holiness means that they have meaning and purpose in their life. And that's really the gist of what we're going to be talking about this week, is the connection of holiness to meaning and purpose. Holiness is such a big subject. I don't want to assume and pretend that I'm talking about everything there is to say. And so I want us to focus specifically on the fact that holiness gives us purpose and meaning. And that is something that we are societally are craving more and more. So I want us to look at how that works. But the path to holiness and the path to meaning is a difficult path. Because in order to come before God in the tabernacle, what do you have to do? You have to sacrifice. The path to a meaningful life, the path to holiness, is the path of sacrifice. You give up something for the sake of something that has purpose and greater meaning than you even can see. And that's Leviticus chapter 6. We see that path into the tabernacle, where it says, the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out. The priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall arrange the burnt offering on it, and shall burn on it the fat of the peace offerings. Fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. It shall not go out. That's what it takes to live a meaningful life, is to be made holy and to be made pure through the fire. And that's the message that is resonating in some ways in the secular world. And it's the message that I believe that we can use as Christians to motivate ourselves to work towards something together that is great and meaningful and powerful, and to invite those in the world who feel like they're living in a wilderness to come with us to the garden that's in our wilderness as we prepare to go into the land that God has brought us, is going to bring us into. And so holiness and sacrifice and meaning, these are some of the things that I hope we will address this week, and we'll continue doing that in the next hour. And so I thank you for your attention this morning. We'll pick up by talking about more connections in the hour to come of the connection between living a holy life and living a meaningful life. So thanks for your attention this morning.